Welcome to Pediatric Insight, where we have candid conversations with members of the Child Health Advisory Council and some of the nation's top academic child health leaders. I am Wesley Milliken, CEO of Career Physician, and your host. Each conversation addresses a leadership challenge or opportunity that's top of mind for today's pediatric leaders. The council breaks it down based on the wisdom and experience obtained throughout their distinguished careers. And now, I'm honored to turn it over to the moderator in today's conversation.
I'm Bruder Stapleton, Chair of the Child Health Advisory Council. Other council members are Craig Hillemeyer, Danielle LaRocca-Rina, Robert Sowen, and Arnold Strauss. I think we're going to talk about a subject that everyone deals with, and that is time management. How do you manage your time? But I want to start off by saying time management is a misnomer. We don't manage time. Time is a fixed constant. You cannot manage it. It's going to be 24 hours every day, not 23 or not 25, and you can't manage that. Only thing we can manage is ourselves and how we use that time. And so we really, when we talk about, quotes, time management, which is the term everyone uses, we're really talking about how do we utilize time. And everyone is too busy. Let's face it. Why do we find it so stressful in our lives? I know a study I did of pediatric chairs a number of years ago found that there was a direct relationship to burnout with the number of hours that chairs spent in their office, which was really astounding sometimes. And so all of us have more to do than we have time to do, and we all have interests and things that drive us for satisfaction. A Harvard Business Review article talked about three areas of skills that were required for managing, utilizing your time. Being aware that time is a fixed resource was one. Two, how do you arrange your time with schedules, plans? And how do you prioritize what's really important and what's not important? And then how do you adapt? Because there is not a single person in academic medicine that doesn't have unexpected things come up. As a clinician, you have crisis in a lab. You may have a deadline or a critical experiment that goes bad, or education. You may have the residents go on strike. You know, who knows? But they're always crises that come up, and how do we manage that? And I think one of the things that I learned is ownership. There are three areas that one has to own. One has to own your day. You know, how do you prioritize your goals? What do you have to accomplish and what do you want to accomplish? You have to own your environment. How do you set up your daily life in terms of interventions, inputs, emails? How do you deal with those? And then how do you own your future? You know, what kind of responsibilities are you willing to take on locally or nationally? Those are all things that control the amount of available time for you to utilize. Maybe we can start off with what are the biggest challenges in utilizing your time? Arnie, do you have any suggestions?
I think you used a word that I found very critical, which is prioritize. So what is your job really? And let's say as chair of pediatrics, your job is to make sure that you develop the faculty, that those faculty have the resources that they need to do their work, whatever it is. Prioritize what is important to your job. The second point I would suggest is to make sure that you develop and delegate work to those who can do it and should do it rather than yourself, and focus on what are the really key issues. One of the axioms that I worked by was to say, out of 1,000 decisions, I only want to make 5. I want everybody else to make the other 995. They have the knowledge, they have the role, and they have the responsibility to make those decisions. There are a few that I have to make. So prioritize and delegate are two of the key features of trying to utilize time. having said that, I must admit that I was terrible at it. You know, I was at work every Sunday and every Saturday, but I felt that it was my responsibility to make sure that I was aware of what was going on and available. And so the faculty rapidly learned that if they really wanted to talk with me, they would come in on Sunday morning. I wasn't very good at it, but I do think that if one prioritizes and delegates, that you have an opportunity to focus on the important issues.
Bob, you have your hands up.
What Arnie said is so spot on. Just one additional thought that I had to learn to delegate as a leader. And then the next error that I made was delegating and assuming that that problem or that issue was off my table. I think an effective leader needs to be able to circle back and support the person to whom you've delegated the responsibility to make sure they're successful. So actually, in the beginning, it might take a little bit of extra work, but eventually, if that person gets their momentum and feels supported, he or she can be successful, and it's one less task on your to-do list. But it did take me a while to learn that you can't just say, okay, you take the ball and run with it. You have to make sure that you give them the support and the follow-up they need.
Thank you, Bob. Danielle, do you have a comment?
For me, I focused on reducing my stress because I am a night bird, so I can work through the night hours, et cetera. But when I had a position where as chair that I needed to drive to get to my place, is I wanted to reduce stress completely from the experience of having, unless I lived there, right, which I wasn't prepared to do. And so I got to work exceedingly early and eliminated the stress of getting to work. In other positions, I was 10 minutes away and knew that that stress wasn't there. So managing the time, because I could do well with long periods, okay? But I also wanted to make sure that I didn't add sort of environmental stress to it. The other is, I actually like time for reflection. This came at the end of my career. I've had, you know, various levels of leadership, including being president of Health Science University. And what was interesting was that I gave time for reflection later on. And that proved to be important. I cut the meetings short and I did walking meetings. So we would walk and talk and actually enjoy the outdoors if it wasn't snowing, and actually got a lot of useful conversation. So that was, I'm really focused on how to reduce stress. And yet, as Arnie said, what's your job? Did you delegate? And did you do it in a way that was healthy for everyone?
Thank you, Daniel. Craig?
I think one of the important things in a leadership position, especially as you move into a new leadership position, is to understand how your body and how your mind responds to stress. And I think it's especially as later in your career, as you get, you have more and more oversight as a chair, dean, health system, executive, you need to understand when you're not happy, when you're upset, when you're angry, how you respond. And different people respond differently to that. And you learn those things by your partner, if you have partners in your life, by the social network that you live in, and you need to develop some close relationships with people who are comfortable enough to talk with you about how you are performing and how you are feeling, because your mental health is really important to that organization. I think that Arnie was right on. It's usually a matter when people who are overworked, it's usually a matter of they haven't delegated or prioritized in a way that's going to let them do that job successfully over the long term. So how does one learn how best to delegate and how to prioritize as you learn in the new positions? And that's by networking with other people who are in that position that you've learned throughout your career. If you have a coach that you've had in the past, or develop coaching relationships to help you understand how best to delegate and prioritize. If you're a division chief and you've got 15 faculty and maybe 30 people working in the lab and 50 people working in the clinic, you can't do all those jobs. If you're a chair and you have, 200 faculty and another 1,000 people supporting those faculty, you can't do all those jobs. And so you've got to learn how best to serve as the leader of that group, what are the important things for you to do? And if you try to do all of them, you won't do any of them very well. And I think, so as Arnie said, what are those five decisions that you might have to make that week? And basically, you want to learn what those decisions are, and you need to take the advice of other people, use your own acumen, use your own experience to understand and develop the ability to identify situations that you need to deal with or that you need to delegate to other people to deal with.
Thank you, Craig. Most often we talk about utilizing time or time management in the context of work-life balance. And everyone's balance is different. I always say that you have a professional life and a personal life. And good work-life balance is, in my opinion, you have a satisfactory and fulfilled personal life and professional life. How that is attained is somewhat different for every individual. I, in contrast to Arnie, after many years of working 7 days a week, I realized that I had a work week that ended on Friday night. I tried not to do email on Saturdays and Sundays, and my work week started at after dinner on Sunday, and I prepared for the week. And every Sunday night was a work night. And our faculty, I told our faculty they could reach me, like Arnie said, by phone anytime on the weekend, but probably may not respond to email unless they called on Saturday and Sunday. And I had one division chief who said he had his emails all set for 7 o'clock Sunday night. He bombarded me every Sunday night. What does occupy your time during the day? And two of the things that I think all of us struggled with were the number of meetings and the emails. Danielle, how did you manage the hundreds of emails that came in every day?
Yeah, it's interesting. Thank you for asking that question. So first of all, in leadership roles, and certainly executive roles, I would give an overview of how emails should be used. Of course, emails that are part of the institutional email system should not be used for personal issues. If you had a personal issue, please don't send it by email. The other is expectation that emails should not be 2 pages long. And so if we can agree that emails are short to the point with a question, then hopefully I would reduce the amount of emails that I would get that would go, you know, a page, 2 pages long, and then have to respond to that. The other is, and I did not do this early on in my career, is to trust your staff. So most of us have the ability to have staff also look at emails, and that should be done in a very trust, you know, someone that absolutely that you have their confidence in a level, that professional level, that they can do that. And I did have that later on in my leadership positions. And again, with the proviso that the email for the institution was never used for personal reasons. But I am guilty as charged, which is that I certainly tried to read as much of my emails as possible. I wanted to be responsive, et cetera. So I don't have a cure for emails, even to this day. I don't have a cure. I did, in leadership position, find that my staff that was highly effective could signal the important emails, and I would make sure that we respond. And there are things such as accreditation issues, policy issues, issues that I really needed to attend to. And I had ongoing communication with my staff that would facilitate my priority list. So that's, again, that's how I think I managed it, maybe not managed my time, but I managed the emails.
Thank you, Daniel. Arnie?
Yeah, I wanted to talk about meetings, which I found one of the most frustrating parts of leadership. Meetings would get scheduled, they'd be held, and nothing would happen. So educating the faculty and staff about the purpose of meetings, how to conduct them, how to reach a resolution, and how to reduce both the number of meetings and the length of time for them, I think was crucial to being able to get things done. So I had a rule, you know, meetings generally are 30 minutes. They're not an hour and a half. And we have to address up front what the question is and what the expectation for the outcome of the meeting is before it happens, so that it can be efficient. I also felt many people use meetings as their way of trying to ingratiate themselves to the leadership. And so I ended up with a list of about 10 people that I would never talk with or never allow to schedule a meeting because they were always bad at it. And the only way to send the message that I found was to say, these people can't do it because they waste my time. And that sounds unresponsive, but in fact, it's the way to communicate to everyone how to conduct a meeting.
There's a wonderful book called Death by Meeting that I think is by the same group that wrote The Crucial Conversations. It's sort of a parable about a lot of these issues that were discussed about meetings and how they can be destructive to an organization, not just inefficient, but destructive if they're not structured the way Arnie described, with clear goals and expectations and so forth. So it's kind of a fun read.
When I took the position at Seattle, I couldn't believe the number of meetings. And basically, like Arnie said, delegating and having decisions made outside the meetings wasn't the style here. They met and they would discuss the same issue week after week. And so after a month here, I said, why are we meeting? This is your job to decide this. This is your job to decide that. And we'll meet so that we can review things at a periodicity, but this all these meetings and the meetings will have a purpose and we'll have agendas. And it just freed up so much time to use because we weren't meeting all the time. And people used to think they had to meet to get permission from me or the group develop a consensus. And I said, you know, you're the head of this, make the decision. And if you need help or, you know, bring that to the whatever monthly meeting or, and we can discuss it, but I trust you. Do your job. And that eliminated a whole lot of meetings. Danielle?
I concur with everything you've said. The other thing that goes along with meetings is minutes. So restructured the minutes to action items and responsible parties. And the first thing that was done was to review who is a responsible party for this action and was it resolved? And if it's resolved and there's an action plan, no need to rediscuss. So I think that efficiency was important in setting the tone. And yes, I went from an hour to certainly 45 minutes, half hour, and sometimes 10 minutes will do. I did have one exception to the minute length. When I met with community leaders, and the agenda setting was already set, that I asked people, if I meet with trainees, I always tell them, give me your agenda ahead of time. And we stuck to that agenda. If I was meeting with community leaders, the purpose of the meeting was relationship building, was slightly different. And I wanted not only to be respectful, but to make sure that I listened carefully. So I would adapt that. It was a little bit different than an academic meeting, a meeting with someone that was reporting to me.
I actually had a consultant who I learned about from my son-in-law who worked in the tech industry, who worked with Microsoft and Expedia to help their employees use their time more widely. And we had a faculty meeting on how to use your day more effectively, not to work harder or longer, but how to free up your day to get accomplished what you need to accomplish. And it was mind-boggling, and the faculty loved it. Because, you know, so much of burnout is and stress is in academics, they think is about promotion and grants. But the day-to-day stresses are, you know, how your work builds up and how you get your job done. And one of the things that she said, how long, if you're working on a grant or you're working on a proposal, someone interrupts you, how long does it take to get back to the same state of concentration? And one of the faculty members said, 30 seconds. And she said, oh, you're a miracle woman. She said, the consultant said, it takes about 10 minutes. So if you have 6 interruptions in a day, you've lost an hour of productive work time. Does your assistant come in and ask you about scheduling an appointment repeatedly? Do you have an alert on your computer like I just had that can distract you? I kind of thought through that. And so my assistant and I scheduled a 15-minute scheduling meeting for future schedules and also for the next day's schedule every day. And then I actually made it for a half hour so I could use 15 minutes to look at emails before my next appointment. How you schedule has a huge, huge impact on the time you have to use during the day. And also the number of interruptions you have is really shocking sometimes and how that saps up your day. Arnie?
Yeah, I just want to agree with you, Bruder, about the interruptions and the way that I tried to avoid that was to reserve time in which no meetings could be scheduled and no one could be interrupted me, and to make sure that the boss at my boss, the assistant, made sure that that happened. So Claire would say, he's not available for the next 2 hours. And people learned to respect that because they knew I was trying to do something. And often it was writing a grant or writing a paper, in which uninterrupted ability to focus was so crucial to being efficient and getting the job done.
Bruder, you mentioned email, and I think it's the bane of all of our existences. One tool that I tried to use was not to, especially I would come in early in the morning because that was time where I knew I wasn't going to get interrupted. And it was very seductive to immediately go to your email. And one habit that I tried to develop was to not open my email until I had set my goals and my priorities for the day. And that was done based on, as Arnie and others mentioned, prioritization. You know, what's important, what's time sensitive, but these are the things that I really want to accomplish today. And spending that time to think about that and prioritize before I even opened email, I think saved me a lot of grief.
Those are great points. This consultant said, imagine, how do you get information? Telephone, is it snail mail, is it emails? Imagine you went and sat by your mailbox and waited for the mail to arrive. And as soon as it arrived, you ripped it open, read it quickly, and then stuck it back in the mailbox for future actions. She said, that's what everybody does with their emails. I have one trick that I learned, and then if anybody has any further things that they, and you know, advice, I'd love to hear it. I like to talk. And when I first became a chair, I was not conscious of time. And I realized that this was awful. You know, I was always behind. People had to wait. And so I put a clock on the wall and that where I could see it, because I always worked at a table, not at my desk, with people that came in. And then I realized they couldn't see the clock. And by the time I retired, I had 7 clocks in my office where no matter where you sat, you could see the clock. And it helped me. And it also helped the individuals you're talking with, because if they really wanted to get something across, they knew that I was going to stop it at the time allotted for them, and they could see. And so it became kind of comical. My chief residence almost every year gave me another clock. And even in my office here at home, I've got about 6 clocks to try and keep me on target. So
I can verify that. And I also think Bruder set those clocks ahead a few minutes, particularly the ones that the other person could see.
Caught me. This has been a really fun conversation, and I'm sure we could talk for a day on this. But I think the important comments that we got today were that, one, you have to be aware that there is a limited amount. There is a time. There is a constant time, and it's not going to be expanded. And two, as Arnie's very well stated, you need to prioritize and understand what your essential job objectives are, what your essential personal objectives are, and also to delegate to others the ability to make decisions so that you're not required as a leader to make all the decisions. Some of the time sinks that affect everyone are meetings, how we do our meetings, what meetings are important, how they're run is critical. People, death by meetings is a common situation, and how we handle our emails. And each person can do that in a different way, but it's important to have a system where you're not just continually overrun and occupying all your time. And we didn't get to social media and web-based things that can be an incredible sink of time and might be a trap for people who do that. And then the issue of interruptions, you know, how you structure with your staff or your assistants, how you schedule and how you allow yourself time for reflection, for time to deal with emergencies, and how to be efficient in doing the jobs that you need to do that require no interruptions. So, and then find a method that gives you satisfaction, both in your professional and personal life. And it's different for everybody. There is no, I always feel badly if somebody says, well, they don't have work-life balance. I mean, to me, if they're enjoying their job and they enjoy their personal life, that's work-life balance. So thanks to everyone for this interesting discussion. And if you're interested in other leadership topics, there are a number of conversations and resources on Career Physicians' website. Thanks.
Thank you for joining us for today's discussion. If you have a question for our council or have a future topic suggestion, please connect with us at pediatricinsight.com. The Child Health Advisory Council is comprised of a diverse group of emeritus deans, department chairs, division chiefs, and child health executives recognized for their leadership contributions in academic pediatrics and child health. The CHAC's impact is further bolstered by council specialty advisors who are active current national leaders in each of the subspecialties in pediatrics. Collectively, the 30-plus members of the CHAC bring unmatched wisdom and experience to career physicians' executive search and leadership development endeavors for its clients. Our council members include the following physicians: Bruder Stapleton, Christine Gleason, Craig Hillemeyer, Renee Jenkins, Danielle LaRocque Arena, Valerie Opapari, Bruce Rubin, Robert Sawin, and Arnold Strauss. To view our council members' bios, please visit careerphysician.com and click on the Child Health Advisory Leadership tab.